Hello?
Hello?
Hi, is this Carlotta?
Yes.
Carlotta, this is Ali Taj. I'm the editor of Let Us Build Pakistan.
Yeah, hi.
I just wanted to say it's a real pleasure speaking to you, and
thank you.
Very, very, very impressed by the work you're doing. And LUBP is an independent blog site that blogs about Pakistan issues, political issues, and particularly we're very concerned about Taliban. And the kind of narrative you're putting forward is very true and very difficult, and you've done a lot of hard work, and we could pursue it further. Anyway, let's kind of talk about what we're going to throw on the blog post. And my first question is that Deobandi Islamic seminaries and clerics have a key role in providing the ideology, the human resource support to terrorist outfits like the TTP, the Sipah-e-Sahaba, Pakistan SSP, and they use different avatars like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which is known to be Al Qaeda's most effective affiliate in Pakistan. To what extent do you agree with this impression, that is the Deobandi madrasas that are doing this?
I think most definitely they are. I think there's no question that they are the first port of call to recruit people, and from what I understand, it's when they're running these madrasas that it's then the religious parties and others, including Al Qaeda, who then are looking out, almost like scouting for possible people to join them, and then draw people from that pool of madrasa students into their organization. So that's the pool where they can find recruits. And from what I understand, they offer extra training courses or sort of periods where they can go, extra study events where they can go off elsewhere from the madrasa during the holidays or during breaks, which is when they sort of almost lure them off to camps or to other areas where they then study. So often students tell their parents, "I'm going off with some of my fellow students on a study course," and that's when they start going off and becoming further radicalized, further indoctrinated in other secluded places, or in other madrasas. But that's how they get lured away, and it's usually the religious parties or organizations that are doing that recruiting.
Makes perfect sense. I don't have any counter on that. My next question is that in March of this year, I don't know if you know about this, that there was a nationwide gathering of Deobandi seminaries in Multan, and a senior Saudi minister was their special guest. The speakers, the senior Deobandi clerics, warned Pakistan against crackdown of Deobandi seminaries or madrasas. How do you analyze this linkage and this kind of threat that they made?
Well, I don't know about that. So this is the first time I've heard about that. So I'm not sure. But I do. Obviously, we all know the connection with Saudi. We know that a lot of Gulf countries have supplied money for these madrasas. I even came across a very interesting snippet that you might have seen also when shortly after Bin Laden was killed, there was. General Pasha, the head of the ISI, had to appear before Parliament for questioning. In fact, General Kiani was also there, but he didn't take questions. But Pasha did take questions, and there was a moment when he was challenged by a member of Fazlur Rahman's party, and Pasha shot back, and this is an account that was in the media. Pasha shot back that words to the effect of, you should keep quiet because we all know you received money from Libya, from Colonel Gaddafi, to your party. And it was a pretty interesting little detail that I found fascinating, that Colonel Gaddafi was also one of these people who was sending funds for these madrasas. So it doesn't surprise me that they have high-level guests, that a Saudi official might be brought in. And I think also I have heard that they have been resisting efforts to crack down or to curtail the activities of the Deobandi madrasas, and inevitably the clerics running them would push back, because you know they would always resist having any controls put on them or any reduction in their numbers or their strength. So that doesn't surprise me. I don't know if it's true, but it doesn't surprise me.
Well, it was widely reported in the media, so I think it's probably true. But no, that's okay. But you're right. You know, they were, Gaddafi was funding them, even Saddam was funding them, and mm-hmm. why they fund these people? You know, why would somebody like Gaddafi or Saddam? Because they want to be able right. to take out some mercenaries. You know, that's
yes, I think so. I mean, it's quite funny because I found that out and I was writing the book. I'm now based in North Africa, so when I visited Libya not long ago, I asked some journalists about that, and they laughed and they said, oh, well, you know, that's Gaddafi, he was almost schizophrenic, he would do things just to stir the pot, you know, to have, you know, so to fund people for various reasons, to have, you know, to make problems or to be active in an area, to have, just to, you understand the word, stir the pot, just to kind of make, you know,
just to make it known
doing,
that he's the guy.
Making trouble. yeah, exactly. So I think there are lots of reasons why these people are doing it. But I mean, for Saudi, we do know that they're very interested in supporting radical Sunni Muslims all over because of their, their rivalry with the whole Shia sect and Iran and so on. So that's very much part of, it's a sort of colonial habit of Saudi to, press, you know, and spread and expand their own form of Deobandi or Wahhabi Sunni Islam in the Muslim world, and I think we've seen that in a lot of countries. So it doesn't surprise me that they're, even after 9/11, they still continue with that obsession.
No, that's very, very true. The only thing that I would say is that, you know, that even if there was, in my opinion, that even if there was no Iran, if you go back before the Iranian Revolution of 1979, this is exactly what they were doing in 1960s. They were their goal to spread their form of radical Wahhabi, Deobandi Islam, has been ongoing since they have, you know, the resources to spend it. So they reinforced their caliphate, if you will, which is, you know, since they're the custodian of the holy mosques, you know, they want to spread that, you know, that following.
Yeah.
Yes, there is an element of, you know, rivalry, but, you know, that rivalry, if it wasn't there, it'd still be going on. Okay, so.
But, you know, I mean, you might as well say they're just doing what the West is doing. You know, we've had missionaries out of, you know, Christian West for centuries, and we still do. And we, especially America, I think, have always believed in spreading our form of civilization around the world. So it's a pretty common colonial habit, unfortunately.
No, that's very true, and that's a valid point. But you know what they're spreading, and what the West or anyone else, you know, even Iran for that matter, may be spreading, is just, you know, there's no comparison, because what they're spreading is a belief that if you know, if you don't believe in what I believe, then, you know, I'll kill you. That is the bottom line of it. Yeah. And I will, you know, I will email you later some excerpts of the interpretation of the Quran that they teach. And there, the very first surah or chapter, as you may well know, is recited at least 17 times a day by good Muslims. And their interpretation basically, you know, calls for the annihilation of Christians and Jews in the very first chapter. So that's not something that is taught by mainstream Sunni or Shia Muslims. This form of Islam that the Saudis are preaching is actually a very small minority which is spreading because they have the resources to do it.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so my next question is, according to an empirical study conducted by the University of Pennsylvania, the Deobandi militants represent more than 90% of terrorist acts in Pakistan, while local Salafi or Wahhabis, which are known as Ahle Hadith, have minimal participation in these terrorist activities. What do you make out of this situation?
I'm really not sure. I haven't studied it that closely. So, and who did that from the University of Pennsylvania?
I will send it to you. I will make a note and email it to you. I'll get your email and I'll send it to you. But the point in that is that the Wahhabis or the Ahle Hadith or the Salafis, which is what the Saudis are, there are not enough of them in Pakistan or India or in that part of the world, especially Pakistan, since we're talking about that. So what they've done is they've forged an alliance with the Deobandis in Pakistan, which they have over time, you know, bought all their leaders,
and
they've kind of made them into a semi-Salafi or a semi-Wahhabi type of deal. Because if we go back, just to let you know, that if we go back to the time when the British funded the Saudis to take over Mecca and Medina, at that time, you know, what they effectively did was destroyed the last caliphate of the Muslims, the Ottomans. And they were much hated by the same Deobandis who sing their songs now. So that's a transformation that's happened over a century, but it's taken a lot of money and a lot of cajoling. And if, you know, and if you talk to an Islamic scholar and they look at the kind of things that the Deobandi scholars say today, is very different from what they used to say, you know, 70, 80 years ago. So that was essentially what's going on there. Okay, so I have another question. Pakistan government is currently holding peace talks with the Taliban. The peace talks are supported by the right-wing parties, that is PMLN of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who's known for his close links with Saudi Arabia, while the secular progressive parties are opposed to the talks. What do you comment on this?
I find the talks, peace talks with the Taliban, almost meaningless in both countries, whether it's in Afghanistan or Pakistan. I know when the ANP did peace talks, I understand that when you want to you want to try and resolve the insurgency, you have to tell all the Pashtun communities that you want peace. I mean, it's evident that you have to show that you're exhausting all peaceful means of resolving differences before you go to resort to military means. And so I understand the need to make overtures and say you're doing peace, but I don't really believe any of the peace talks are real peace talks. I think a lot of the deals that the Pakistan military did with the Pakistani Taliban in the past were just fake deals, really. They were just convenience ceasefires or kind of pretend peace talks. And so I'm not really sure what to believe about this latest round. I'm sure Samuel Haq and Rustam Shah and Nomand are trying to reach out to people, but I just don't believe anything will come of it, because I don't think either party are really sincere in trying to resolve things. And I also think the Taliban are at the stage where they're absolutely not interested in negotiations with the state in any real way. They have their behind-the-scenes dealings with the ISI, and I think that's how things will continue. So I think it's a bit of a show, always, these peace talks. And
do you think that the end result, like you mentioned, is that they're trying to make a show that we tried peace and now we have to use force? Is that where do you think they're going, or is it something else?
I haven't talked enough to the PMLN people, but I think at first, yes, that is what they were trying to do. I think they were, threatening, as you know, to do an operation in North Waziristan. They did do some bombing in one area. So I think, and from what I understand in their talks with America, they were very serious that they were finally going to get tough. But then something happened, and they didn't do an operation, but the peace talks didn't really go anywhere. So I think someone intervened and it sort of collapsed, or it's just not going anywhere. So that's why I'm rather skeptical about these peace talks, because I haven't seen, over the years of watching them, I've never seen any real peace talks happen.
We agree on that part, but what you're also saying, mm-hmm. kind of there, is that yes, they're doing something, but it's really not explainable where it's going, or what direction it will take, because there's something else that's stirring the pot, if you will.
Yeah, and I think what it is, I think that Nawaz Sharif's government definitely did want to advance something, but I think they have a great deal of trouble where they're not really in control of the dialogue or of the scene. So you've got the military and the ISI who've got much stronger levers over the Taliban, I think can intervene.
What about the whole Syrian situation? Does that come into play in this? Because recently we saw that Saudi Arabia gave $1.5 billion to Pakistan just mm-hmm. as a quote-unquote gift, and in return they wanted some shoulder-fired missiles to protect themselves, which, Reid sent to Syria. And also, we found a lot of evidence of madrasa people or Taliban or whatever you want to call it being shipped to Syria. These people are also being shipped to Bahrain to beef up their security forces. So do you think that has something to do with it?
I don't know if it's connected. I mean, I think that Saudi has given money to Pakistan before, and sometimes just sort of, whether it's fuel, cheap fuel, or or budgetary support, so they could be just helping out someone who, as you say, is an old ally who's had always very good relations with Saudi. So it's totally possible that the 1.5 billion, you know, is unattached and just general financial support. But I think there have been deeper agreements on all this training of militant forces that has, as we know, since the Afghan, you know, war against the Soviets, there's been this relationship. And I've always felt that the Saudis, you know, had an interest, for example, in seeing the Arabs remaining, having a sanctuary in Pakistan after they fled Afghanistan in 2001. I'm sure the Saudis were requesting that of Musharraf. I have no proof, but it just all makes sense. They didn't want to see them all slaughtered. They didn't want to see them sent back to Saudi, so they just sort of asked Pakistan to give them sanctuary. So that, all those sort of things.
So I think they kind of want them around, but they don't want them in their own country.
Yes, and I think they didn't want bin Laden killed as well, or handed over. So better to just have him go to ground in Pakistan.
So Pakistan being a poor country is, you know, in a way easily exploitable as a place where they would send their trash to keep, because it's kind of not, you know, not good for them on the street to have these people killed or tried, and, you know, just keep them, have them live it out. Is that maybe some part of it?
Yeah, but I don't think that's any excuse just because you're a poor country to do that sort of thing. Because in the end, you get the backlash and that harms you. So it's very, very foolish. I'm not saying that all of these guys are bad. You know, I'm aware there are quite a few Arabs and Chechens and Egyptians who did, after the war against the Soviet Union, just stayed on in Pakistan and lived, you know, fairly quiet, law-abiding lives, from what I understand.
No, that's very, very true. That's very, very true.
A lot
of them did speak out very vocally against some of their, you know, bad cousins as well.
You know, so those people, I'm well aware that those people could not return to their home countries because of repression. You know, I know the Chechen case very well. I have great sympathy for Chechens who couldn't return home because it's such an awful regime. Mm-hmm. I think Egypt under Mubarak was similar, you know, and I do see that it's the repression from some of those regimes that is the cause of so many of these Muslim fighters who've you know, gone elsewhere to wage jihad. It's partly because they're driven from their own homes by repression. So I have sympathy there, but I do think it's been very foolish of Pakistan to tolerate active militancy among these guys, because you can't keep perpetuating that and without damaging yourself and your neighbors.
So are they just foolish? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get to. I agree this is completely foolish, and, you know, we want this stopped. But what is their motivation, do you think? Why do they keep doing it?
Well, I think in my experience, when you have a military following a policy that's not good, it's often just because they've always done it. It's all that they know. It's always been the policy, so they keep doing it. And it's because military organizations or the military in any country is often not a policy making or a political body. They just follow orders and they just carry out orders. And I think this is where Pakistan's got onto a ruinous course, because the military is in charge, and I think they are not really thinking about the value of this policy. And I think this is where politicians then political leaders have to come to the fore and control, take over charge of the way, you know, the policy of the country, the foreign policy, the security policy, because the military don't seem to be capable of stopping themselves, and they're just pursuing a course of action that they've always done, and it's actually got more and more extreme and more bloodthirsty, and they don't seem to be able to pull themselves up and stop.
So what you're saying is, because of whatever factors, let's say it was Kashmir or whatever, they started this thing, it became sort of an institutionalized industry, if you will, and they just keep running it. And you know, and the unique position in Pakistan is that Pakistan is a country, unlike other countries, which is controlled by the army, more or less. And that's kind of the problem. And sometimes we joke that every other country has an army, and Pakistan, the army has a country. So,
yes. So yeah, I mean, it's well documented exactly, yeah, how much they control. So I do think that the institution has just become too big and too stuck in its ways.
Now, I know we're going a little bit over time. Are you okay with that, or?
That's okay. Yeah, keep going.
Okay, so in this, you know, I just, you know, I mean, this was not part of my plan, but I mean, I would like to bring in the Pakistan's own insecurity as well. That, you know, part of the reason they keep going on with this is internally in Pakistan, they have issues with, for example, the Balochistan issue is very much there. So Gilgit-Baltistan may be another issue. So what they're doing, you know, while you write in your New York Times article that they were, you know, harboring OBL, I mean, they're harboring, you know, hordes of these people to fight the Baloch insurgents or to try and bring demographic change in Gilgit-Baltistan. And, you know, so they're not only harboring Al-Qaeda, they're harboring Lashkar-e-Changwi, Sepah-e-Sahaba, all these avatars of the same kind of, you know, Wahhabized Deobandi thinking. So what do you think about that, or if you have any comments?
Well, again, I think I mean, I don't know so much about Gilgit-Baltistan, but certainly I've been to Balochistan a few times, and it's very distressing what's happening there, because it's really it's a terrible crime what's happening. The amount of people who've been assassinated, the waging of a war against your own people, you know, is really appalls me. And I come back to the same thing, that I think if the civilians actually could control things, they would long ago have ordered an end to it, and, you know, an amnesty for the Baloch who are fighting, and resolve it, because you can't have a constant war against your own people like that and not damage your country and even, you know, possibly the integrity of Pakistan. You know, the Baloch are just becoming more and more angry and disaffected, to the point where, you know, I've just seen the struggle change from, you know, wanting more, a greater share of the natural resources found in Balochistan, to now open calls for separation and independence. So that, I think that's very, very distressing and very wrong of the military to be pursuing such a very repressive campaign there. And I think they're misguided there. They think, I think they argue that there is, interference by outside actors. Namely, they blame it on India sponsoring that struggle. And I think that's just willful and wrong. If India is at all supporting it, it's minor compared to the internal disaffection of the Baloch. So there should be immediately a political solution to that. And I don't see the military capable of that. And that's where I think, again, Pakistanis need to seize hold of their own military and bring a halt to some of their actions.
Well, I wonder if you're aware that the military or the military, you know, apologists in the media openly say this, and I'll quote, that the military in Pakistan or the army is responsible for keeping intact both the geographic and the ideological boundaries of Pakistan. So this is this cleansing and getting people in line to you know, nobody can be diverse, nobody is allowed to be a different kind of Muslim or a Christian. It is oppression on Christians. Hindus are being forced converted, and they see the madrasa and the Middle Eastern funding of it as a vehicle to homogenize Pakistan, if you will, into a particular kind of Islam. And that's the long standard. I mean, we forget about the Pashtuns. The Pashtuns themselves were not always so radical either. And they have been, they were the first to be radicalized because they were the biggest threat in terms of forming a Pashtunistan with Afghanistan. So they, that's kind of, anyway, I'll definitely email you about that too. Okay, so, and there's some things that could really help strengthen your case there in terms of the history of it. Okay, so my final question is about the media, which is, I wonder if you know this Pakistani scholar, Dr. Aisha Siddiqa.
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
well.
Oh, that's good. So we have a common friend then. she has written that Pakistani military establishment manages the media discourse through its proxies in English and Urdu press in both right-wing and liberal sections of the media. To what extent do you agree with this allegation, given that some of the English-speaking liberal sections of the Pakistani media were protesting your research?
She knows it better than me, but I do touch on this in the prologue of my book, where I try and show, you know, in brief, what I understand is that there's been a very sophisticated way of controlling the media. I mean, there's the basic intimidation, roughing up of journalists, even killing of a few to scare the rest. But there's also this very insidious way of placing editors and sympathetic reporters and working with them to the point that you actually then dominate the discourse in the media. And that, I think, has been a long-time project, and so that you now see some very sympathetic right-wing figures in important positions in the media who run the discourse, and then they often get special briefings from the ISPR as to how to tackle certain subjects. So we saw, for example, after the killing of bin Laden, you know, the senior editors were given guidelines of how, what to discuss, and so it was, they were warned off discussing the issue of did the ISI know bin Laden was there, and they were encouraged to, you know, hammer away at this issue of this is an abuse of Pakistan's national sovereignty, you know, America doing a unilateral raid like that and it's coming in under the radar. And so, you know, all of the media basically didn't discuss the key point. They went bashing away on a point that was, okay, obvious, but wasn't very edifying because it didn't really reveal anything more. So that there was a very sophisticated way of managing the message. But I think what most people tell me is the most insidious way is, as you've mentioned, having sympathetic voices in important positions in the media. So what appears to be a free media is actually dominated by like-minded people.
Exactly.
And that's resulted in, yes, in this chorus in support of the military, when in fact media should be really questioning the performance and the intentions of the military.
Well, not just the military, but in fact what we found is that even the so-called quote-unquote liberal part of the media, which talks about human rights and women's rights, but at the same time is promoting the chief figures of the Taliban, or the ASWJ or LEJ leaders are being promoted on that same media as ambassadors of peace. So just furthering the agenda of Talibanization.
And you see that they're not very good journalists, in fact, because they're not really asking the good questions. So I just hope that journalism in Pakistan will improve, because those figures who are so well known and apparently liberal, you see that they're not often asking the right questions or digging in the right way.
They just give them softball questions and give them promotional space to legitimize them, basically.
Yeah.
It's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have a sort of similar type in Fox News and so on. So, you know, it's not unheard of in other countries. But it is, it means you can't really say that Pakistan has a vibrant...
Over here, if you have the Fox News, you know, we have the counter to that also. So,
sure, yeah.
But there you just have one thing going on, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I really, really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. I mean, I really enjoyed this discussion.